around who was the fastest bowler. And I remember every single practice session when he would get in the net, it was his turn to practice batting. I'd do my best to tenderize him a little bit. And then when it was my turn to get into the nets, he tried his best to do it as well. I'd like to say mostly I smacked him around for sixes, but I remember one practice, there was this one particular ball that was just perfect. It was a full toss. It was coming in for a six. I could see the crowds raising their number six little banners, and I took my biggest swing perfectly. No, I didn't perfectly time it. Completely freshied it and earned my first broken rib. And it was quite painful. And what they don't tell you about a broken rib is that it's a nuisance. There's nothing you can do. You can't wrap it in plaster Paris. You can't kind of do anything. You just have to suffer for 6 weeks. You can't sleep. Turning over is painful. Coughing, sneezing, everything is terrible. And I kind of managed to make it through, and I couldn't play sport, which was terrible. I actually had to focus on academics for a little while. And it was just painful. And as I was kind of getting better, the seasons were turning. I think it was kind of heading into winter a little bit, and I had held off a sneeze, and I just couldn't hold off any longer. And I let out the biggest sneeze and cracked my rib once again. And it was just terrible. And just in a funny little kind of way, I was reminded of this as I was preparing for today, because some of you know what it's like to carry pain with you everywhere you go. You can't avoid it. You can't put it to one side. It's just with you wherever you walk, wherever you turn, you feel it. And that's what we're going to be looking at this morning as we continue on in our series on the book of Job and the life of Job, this man who experiences unimaginable loss and suffering and carries grief with him. And what he does to trust God, even in the midst of his questions and unanswered grief and suffering. And we wanted to do the series for a few reasons, because I think, as Doug said a couple of weeks ago, there are people in the room currently going through it. And some of us are maybe not going through it, but we're banking stuff for the future. And hopefully all of us are learning how to love one another well when we do go through these times. And I'd just like to start off by saying, I think this is an especially important topic for believers, because one of the difficulties or challenges of suffering for believers is that we're forced to make sense of what we know to be true about God and his love for us, and what seems like an opposite kind of dissonance of what we're experiencing. And we have to kind of reconcile this gap between what we know about God's love for us and kind of the opposite of what we seem to be experiencing. And so it's a major challenge for us that even while we are confused and maybe disoriented or angry with God, we still know that he cares and loves about us deeply. And we have this journey that we have to go through of reconciling the gap. And that's exactly where our friend Job finds himself this morning. If you're coming into the movie halfway and you don't know the context, let me recap very quickly. Job, we believe, is a real man, even while the book of the Bible is written poetically. He's a real guy. He's also a righteous guy. Several people in the Bible refer to him as one of the righteous men to ever live. I think it's Ezekiel who says Noah, Daniel, and Job are like the three biggest or most righteous men to ever live. And yet, even despite his righteousness, he suffers incredible loss. And while it's happening real time, he doesn't know why it's happening. He has no context for it, and he's really wrestling. And reading the book, we have a little bit more of a context, and we can zoom out and kind of see the fuller picture. And what we read is that Satan approaches God and has a bit of a wager with him and says, listen, let me take everything away from this guy, all his success, all his wealth, even his family, and this is what will happen. I bet you that if you let me do that, he'll deny you. He'll reject you. He won't believe in you anymore. He'll even curse you. And what we see by the end of Job is a guy who has somehow, in the midst of unimaginable loss and grief, has remained faithful to God and still clings on to hope in him, even when he can't make sense of what he's going through. That's what I want us to look at today, is how does Job look up when life gets him down? How does he cope through these seasons of incredible loss? How does he walk by faith in the midst of pain? How does he suffer when he doesn't know why he's suffering? And I think before we get to unpacking various portions of the story of his life and look at a few verses, I just want to maybe say this, and you'll know this already if you're going through grief, but there is no formula to grief here. So my three points here today are not the three biggest points that if you just do this, you'll come out the other side alive. Grief is up and down. But I do believe these are three helpful windows into a man who clings onto God in the face of unimaginable suffering. And I want us to look at three resources Christians have to face suffering. Three resources Christians have to face suffering. And the first one is this, is the honesty of lament. Now, I want us quickly, as we get an overview of Job and his situation, just to kind of walk through the different phases and stages he finds himself in while he's processing his loss and while he finds himself grieving. Just to get us a window into his hardened soul. And remember, he's lost everything. His friends come around him to be with him, to comfort him. They're in silence. And then, as Doug said, they ruined it by starting to speak. And Job finds himself questioning and wondering why this happens. Like, did I do something? And that's the first thing he questions in Job 7. He's wondering if maybe he's done something to deserve this. He says in verse 20, "If I have sinned, what have I done to you, Watcher of humanity?" So he's really entered into the space of seeking and searching and questioning. Have I done anything to deserve this? Why is this happening, God? I don't understand. By chapter 12, he seems to have made a little bit of progress. And he says this in verse 10 of chapter 12. He says, "The life of everything, every living thing, is in his hand, as well as the breath of all humanity." Okay, this is encouraging. He's questioning, but he's come to a place of surrender, trusting that God is with him and that God is in, he's in God's sovereign care. He's trusting God. But maybe not for long. A couple chapters later, in chapter 17, verse 1 and 2, he's in the dumps of depression and dejection once again, and he says this, "My spirit is broken. My days are extinguished. A graveyard awaits me. Surely mockers surround me, and my eyes must gaze at their rebellion." Two verses later, he says, verse 15 and 16, "Where then is my hope? Who can see any hope for me? Will it go down to the gates of Sheol? Will we descend together to the dust?" This is the picture of a man in incredible brokenness and feeling hopeless. In one way, it's beautiful that he can be so honest about this. And we see again a few chapters later, he's kind of rallied a little bit, and in his questioning and in his exasperation, he gets to a place of at least trusting that God is still good and kind and fair. And he kind of gives this picture of a kind of courtroom. And he says this in chapter 23 from verse 2. He says, "Today also my complaint is bitter. His hand is heavy despite my groaning. If I only knew how to find him so that I could go to his throne, I would plead my case before him. I would fill my mouth with arguments. I would learn how he would answer me and understand what he would say to me. Would he prosecute me forcefully? No, he would certainly pay attention to me. Then an upright man could reason with him, and I would escape from my judge forever." And so what he's doing here in this court kind of analogy, what he's saying is, despite my lack of understanding and despite my unimaginable grief, I still know that God is fair. He's still a just God. I don't understand why this is happening, but I know He's still fair and just. It's a great place to get to. And in some ways, it would be wonderful if that's where Job kind of landed. That's not how grief works, is it? Job chapter 30, one of the last things he says before his final friend and eventually God speaks, Job says this: "But when I hoped for good, evil came. When I looked for light, darkness came. I'm churning within and I cannot rest. Days of suffering confront me." Part of why I wanted to give us an overview of Job's kind of suffering and our grief journey is just to say this, that grief is messy. It's not clean. You don't move from brokenness to wholeness. It's not like, yeah, okay, you can suffer for 2 weeks, but then we kind of get back on the horse and get on with life. It's just not how it works. You don't become Mr. Positive all of a sudden. It's so up and down. And you see that in the life of Job. He's trusting God, then he's deeply disoriented. He's resting, and then he's wrestling. He's struggling, but he's still hoping. And you see the full picture of it. And what's amazing about Job is that the book tells us that despite his questions, it says he grieves without sinning. He grieves without sinning. He gets a little bit close at times in how he speaks to God, but he grieves without sinning. So how does he do that? And I'm convinced, having studied and read and lived in this book for a couple of weeks now, that I think one of the keys to Job's healing journey is that he learns how to lament. He learns how to lament. He learns to suffer well, partly because he learns to lament honestly. And maybe you're hearing that word for the first time. What is lamenting? What does that even mean? I would maybe give it this definition. I'd say lamenting is honest prayer in the midst of your pain that leads you to a place of trusting God. Right? It's honest prayer in the midst of your pain that leads you to a place of trusting God. It's quite amazing, right? Job feels a full freedom to bring his full brokenness and pain and even frustration and hash it out with God. Like this perfect righteous man who grieves without sinning says some pretty strong stuff to the Lord. And it's a major theme of this book, is this wrestling of his heart, trying to make sense of his pain, trying to kind of work it through. And it's such an encouragement to us that what he does is he laments. That's where he gets to. And I think when we suffer, we kind of tend to go one of two ways. We tend to either suck it up and suffer in silence and kind of just get on with life, pretend it doesn't exist, try push it down, ignore it. And so we're incredibly dishonest because God knows what's going on in our heart, but we don't want to tell him that. We lie and we hide it. Or we do the opposite end of the spectrum where we give God the silent treatment because we're angry with him. He doesn't deserve our kindness and our engagement. It's a sin. It's dishonesty and sin. And so what Job is telling us is that, no, there's a more beautiful, more honest, more life-giving, more freeing third way, and it's the way of lament. You don't have to pretend it doesn't exist. You don't have to give God the silent treatment. There's something more beautiful than suffering in silence. You don't need to be a silent sufferer. If you're finding your place, yourself in this place this morning, I want to recommend a resource. It's a book called Dark Clouds, Deep Mercy. Beautiful book I read a couple of years ago that really helped me process the season I was in. And his name is Mark, I would say Frugop as a South African, but I think he's American, so he says Frugop. But it's really a great book, and he deals with this idea of lament and what it looks like biblically. And he provokes us a bit here. This is what he says. He says, "To pray in pain, even with its messy struggle and tough questions, is an act of faith where we open our hearts to God. Prayerful lament is better than silence. However, I found that many people are afraid of lament. They find it too honest, too open, or too risky. But there's something far worse: silent despair. Because we don't have to live in silent despair. I think if you're finding yourself in that place and you don't want to pray to God, it's maybe because you kind of feel like He doesn't care, so why pray? But what we're actually seeing here is that praying in the midst of your pain is an incredible act of faith. Right? Like, it's easy to pray when life is going well. When life is not going well, that's when it counts and when you need it the most, and where you give God, as it were, the greatest opportunity to meet you in your pain. That's what grief is meant to do. And it's incredibly honest and raw. And to help us a bit here, I was just thinking this morning about how this plays out. I think everyone in the room will know what it's like to sit with someone who's suffering or just going through the ringer, right? Now, imagine this is maybe someone close to you, like a best friend or a family member, someone you're very close with. And imagine you're with them in a group of people. Some of them they may or may not know. One of them knows that they're not doing too well and asks them, "Hey man, how are you doing?" They might respond by saying, "Yeah, not too well. Life is tough, but I'm all right. Thanks for asking." Now imagine the rest of those guys go away and it's just you and your mate who know each other well, who have a strong connection, strong relationship, and you ask them, "Hey man, how are you doing?" That's when you're going to get the real answer, right? That's when you're going to get the unfiltered, raw stuff. And what lament is meant to do is tell you that that's what it's like with you and your kin. You have an opportunity to give God the raw stuff, the real stuff. You don't have to kind of, it's God. You can't say that stuff to God. He's holy and greater than all. Like, He doesn't want to hear your stuff. No. Like, sort that out with a therapist and then you can come pray proper, polished prayers. No, man. Have you read the book of Job? Have you read half the Psalms? Have you read, the book of Lamentations? Like, it's in the Bible. It's literally in the Bible. There's a way of praying in the midst of your pain that is honest and freeing and beautiful, where you get to engage God with your "I don't knows, I don't understand, why God, how long, O Lords," and trust that He's with you in the midst of it, even if you don't feel Him. It's a necessary process to lament. And I was encouraged by this and provoked by this by a ministry mentor I met with recently. I meet with him about once a month. He's a wonderful older man who's been in ministry like much longer than I've even been alive. And he had experienced incredible loss in his early life. He had just gotten married, just had a son. And in one day, his wife and sister died in a car accident, leaving him behind with a young son. And by God's grace, he got remarried, been married for decades now. They've had more kids. They have a beautiful family, wonderful ministry. God is so redemptive and kind. But I was chatting to him about grief and about his journey. And one of his reflections was that he was too triumphant in that season. He was too triumphant. He was doing the right stuff. He was quoting the scriptures. He was believing the gospel. He was replacing lies with truth. He really believed it was going to be okay, but he was too triumphant. He says he didn't give himself enough time to sit in the grief and lament. And he says it short-circuited his healing journey because there was actually a dissonance between the way he was acting and the way his heart was feeling. And so what lament does is it helps you bridge that gap between what you're experiencing and the goodness of God to lead you to a place of healing in His presence as you give yourself to it. There's a beauty in the honesty of lament. You don't need to pretend. You don't need to hide. God's not expecting your best self. He saved you at your worst. He can deal with you at your worst. He wants you at your worst. Give him the opportunity to father you and love you as a perfect dad. Right, the second thing I think we're seeing in the life of Job here is that he faces suffering in a way that encourages us towards the freedom of grace. Now, basically what happens in chapters 40 to 31 is this back and forth Job has with his friends. There's four friends, and for the first sort of 28 chapters, three of his friends are giving him advice, and Job responds. And then the next one speaks again, and he responds. And there's this total back and forth. And this, as I said, friends aren't very helpful, but I think this is a decent summary of the gist of what they say in that massive length of words. When his friend Bildad speaks, he gives him some advice in Job chapter 8, and he says this: "But if you earnestly seek God and ask the Almighty for mercy, if you are pure and upright, then he will move even now on your behalf and restore the home where your righteousness dwells." I think that's a decent summary of what his first three friends say to him. They're saying, "Mate, you've clearly done something, some sin, to deserve this incredible loss and suffering." And Job maintains, "No, I don't have any unrepentant sin. I haven't done anything to deserve this. I don't know why it's happening, but I know it's not that." And how Job responds is incredibly instructive for us, because what Job is doing is he's asking the deeper questions. Read with me. It's Job chapter 9. He responds in verse 2 and 4. He says this to Bildad: "Yes, I know what you've said is true. But how can a person be justified before God? If one wanted to take him to court, he could not answer God once in a thousand times. God is wise and all-powerful." And later at the end of the chapter, verses 32, 35, he says this: "For God is not a man like me that I can answer him, that we can take each other to court. There is no mediator between us to lay his hand on both of us. Let him take his rod away from me so his terror will no longer frighten me. Then I would speak and not fear him. But that is not the case. I am on my own." What Job is essentially asking for is he just wants to know he's okay with God. He just wants to know that he's all right, that there's nothing in the way between them. And what he's saying is he can't know for sure where he stands because there is no mediator. But this is an essential question in the book of Job. He's wrestling and confused about what he's going through. He's disoriented. He's doubting. He just doesn't know for sure where he stands. And this causes him confusion and angst. And so he says here, he wishes he could take God to court so he could get an understanding of what the charge is. "God, what's the charge? What did I do? Please, can I take you to court? I'd love to do that. Let's figure this out." Now, to do that, Job would need a really good lawyer. You know where this is going. It's beautiful. You see, he asks God, "I wish I could have a mediator. Then someone could figure it out between us, and I'd know where I stand. God, I need someone between us who's going to fight my case." Now, here's the beautiful thing: we live on this side of history with a mediator, and his name is Jesus. He stood in the gap between us and God. 1 Timothy 2 says this, verses 5 and 6. "For there is one God and one mediator between God and mankind, the man Christ Jesus, who gave himself as a ransom for all, a testimony at the proper time." See, friends, this is beautiful. You and I deserve the suffering and the punishment that is coming to us. We deserve the sentence. We deserve the charge. But we have an excellent lawyer in Jesus, who stands between us and the Father, who pleads our case, who does such a good job that he clears our name so that the judge, the Father, declares us not guilty. not guilty. And I want to be clear here. Jesus didn't just get us off of a parking ticket. Jesus got us off death row. We were on a one-way guilty sentence to death. And he stood in our gap. He paid the ransom. By his blood, he paid the price for our guilt to make us right with God. He serves the time instead of us. He dies on the cross for our sin in our place. Here's the good news, friends. Job needed a mediator. We have a mediator in Jesus. You can know for sure where you stand. You don't have to doubt or question or wonder what God thinks about you, feels about you, whether you're on his good side. You can know for sure where you stand. Maybe this morning you haven't made the decision to trust in Jesus. I just want to encourage you with that today. He's a really good lawyer. And you can know where you stand. You can have that declaration spoken over you, not guilty. You can have in an instant all your past sin and dirt cleansed and forgiven. In Jesus, you can be made whole. You can know the freedom of his grace. Now, you might be asking, this is great, but what does this have to do with grief and suffering? And I'd say everything. Here's why. Because when you're suffering, as I've said many times already, you will have questions that overwhelm you and cause you to spin. Your inner life will often feel like turmoil. You'll just be wrestling at a deep level that's hard to express, but you know what it's like if you're in there. The questions and unanswered objections that you have to your Father will even eat you up at times. There'll be a lot you don't know. But here's where we have to come back to. What do you know? What do you know? You might not know why you're suffering, but it can't be that God doesn't love you. It can't be that God doesn't care. It can't be that God has abandoned you. No, the gospel proves that those are not true. He dies for the ones he loves. It shows that he cares. It shows that he is committed to you, that he would leave heaven and come to seek and save you and I, those who were lost, that he would come and find us. You might not know why the things that are happening to you are happening. There'll be a lot you don't know. But what do you know? You know that you were bought at a price. You know that you are sons and daughters of the God, of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. You know that his Spirit lives in you and will keep you to the end. You know that you can't wriggle your way out of your grip, no matter how hard you might try. God's too strong to let go of you. What do you know? All these promises of God tell us that there's such freedom in his grace. I just want to make this clear. What does this mean about suffering and pain? I think it means this, that simply it means that you're not without help and hope today. You're not without his grace today. You're not going to suffer alone because you're not alone. His Spirit is with you and he will help you. He will never abandon you. But his grace frees us from the tyranny of despair. You can know where you stand. You can know the one who holds you. And so I think thirdly, just as we close here, I think Christians have the comfort of his presence. As a resource to help us when we struggle. We have the comfort of his presence. See, in Job chapter 13, Job prays this prayer. He says, only grant these two things to me, God, so that I will not have to hide from your presence. Remove your hand from me. Do not let your terror frighten me. Then call, and I will answer. or I will speak and you can respond. Right, Job repeats these sentiments time and time again throughout the chapters that follow. And what he's really saying is he just wants to know the comfort of God's presence. Just wants to know that God is with him and for him. I think it's really important, the words he uses there, because he's identifying something profound. He's saying God's presence results in one of two things. It either results in comfort and the peace of his presence, or it results in terror. And you can say, he's saying, you know, he wants to know that he's safe and at peace, that he's okay with God so that he won't have to be terrified. He's saying, God, I don't want to have to hide from your presence. But good news is that if you're in Jesus, as Hebrews says, you can run to the throne of grace with confidence because there's nothing left to fear. Jesus has taken care of everything. You're okay with God. He loves you as a father loves his child. There is no terror, nothing to fear. We only get his comfort. And so 2 Corinthians 1:3-4 says this. It says, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and the God of all comfort. He comforts us in our affliction so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any kind of affliction through the comfort we ourselves receive from God. As a God of comfort for you today. That there is no situation too complex for him to break into and help you in. That you are not abandoned or alone, but he is for you and he wants to comfort you. He'll comfort you by even by his Spirit. It's a gift of God's comfort to us. Remember John 14 and multiple other places in the New Testament, the Holy Spirit is called the Comforter, the Counselor. The Greek word is paraclete. The idea is that he's the one who comes alongside us to help us, to carry us, to strengthen us, to encourage us. It's what he does by his Spirit. No, I wonder if you've ever experienced that. Maybe we need a fresh filling today of his Spirit, that we would know his Spirit and his presence with us. I remember years ago, we had a church camp and we had this beautiful ministry moment where we were kind of praying for one another, just friends praying for one another to be freshly filled with the Spirit. And this lady came forward and I got the privilege of praying with her and I just said, like, what can I pray? What can I pray for you for? And she just shared a little bit of how she'd been struggling and she just says, I just need to know God is near and that he's with me. And so we prayed. I just prayed, you know, Father, please would you fill this lady with your Spirit? Would you encourage her? Would you lift her? As I was praying, I felt, and I can't really, it doesn't always happen this way. In fact, it usually doesn't, but I felt this time like a kind of like defibrillator kind of feeling. It was like there was an impartation that happened, just that God blessed the moment. I don't really know how to explain it, but I couldn't help myself. I opened my eyes. I just said, did you feel that? And she was crying. Yeah, I did. It was a beautiful moment as God again fills you and encourages you with his Spirit. And friends, it can happen. I feel like I just need to say, it doesn't always happen that way. And sometimes, especially when you're grieving, it can feel like God is far away. You can feel a distance between God, even though you've been brought near by the blood of Christ. It can feel like there's 1,000 miles between you and your Father. Grief kind of has a way of doing that. But this morning, we're going to pray for one another. We're going to pray for you to trust that God is with you. And maybe, just maybe, he would bless us by again filling us with his Spirit, that we would know he's here, that you would have an undeniable sense of him being with and for you. That he's holding us and we can trust him. I just want to end with Isaiah Chapter 41, verse 10. So as we ready our hearts and kind of tell our hearts to again trust in this God who is with us and for us. Isaiah says this. He says, do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be afraid, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. I will hold on to you with my righteous hand. Some of us just need to let that wash over us this morning. That he is with you. That he will strengthen you. That he will hold on to you. You will not slip through his hands. You will not slip through his hands. He knows what you're going through. And he loves you. He's with you. He's for you. We're going to have a ministry time and respond in a bit more worship. And let's just pray together as we come to a time of response, as we freshly trust in God to be with us and to help us and to strengthen us. Jesus says this in Matthew 11, verses 28 to 30. He says, "Come to me, all of you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, because I am lowly and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Father, thank you that the invitation is not complicated. Thank you that it's not complicated. The invitation is to come. We want to come to you this morning, God. We want to trust these verses and what we've heard this morning that is true of you, and that you have every desire to meet us, to comfort us, and to strengthen us this morning. Thank you, God, that there is nothing we can do to achieve or summon your presence among us. Thank you that there's nothing we need to do to earn your grace. Thank you that your heart is to meet your people with refreshing grace this morning. I pray for that right now, Lord, as we respond in singing and prayer. I pray that you would refresh us. I pray that you would wake us up from our distraction and help us remember our help comes from you. There is nowhere else we can look. There is no other ultimate hope. It's you and you alone, Jesus. We look to you this morning. We come to you. We rely on you. Would you come meet us by your Spirit now as we worship and respond? In Jesus' name, amen.